I don't know about you, but I remember all too vividly the number of days we weren't able to assemble because of sickness, and now I cherish every assembly we have with greater joy than I ever could have without that experience. It's good to see you here this evening, and I pray that our lesson will be helpful to us all. I invite you to turn to Mark chapter 4, which is where our lesson will be taken from. The lesson is entitled, Cold Water Quenched the Disciples' Faith. Someone has said that the scalded dog fears cold water. Think about that. Once he's been scalded with water, he'll be afraid of any kind of water, even cold water. And you see something like this in the disciples here. The Sea of Galilee is one of the most famous seas in the world. It's oftentimes called a lake, more properly, I think, in size, but it can be called a sea. When you look at the stats concerning the Sea of Galilee, it's 13 miles long, it's 7.5 miles wide, it's shaped like a pear. It's 680 feet below sea level. I remember teaching a geography class once, and I pointed this out, and somebody said, "Now, wait a minute, I have a question. How can this sea be 680 feet below itself?" Well, we're talking about the Mediterranean. This is an inland lake, as it were, on 680 feet below the Mediterranean. That's the sea we're talking about. Mount Hermon stands very near it. It's 9,200 feet. Think about that combination. This cold, cold, snowy air from Mount Hermon that comes down in sort of channels, many rivulets and channels that come down from Mount Hermon, mixing with the air of the Sea of Galilee. The cold gusts mix with the warm breezes right off the Mediterranean. And then the warm air hovering over Galilee. And in a moment's time, this Sea of Galilee can go from a very calm place to a place we don't want to be in. More about that as the lesson goes on. Now, as we look at this in Mark chapter 4, notice with me in verse 35. This is also recorded in Matthew 8 and Luke 8. But our primary text this evening will be Mark 4, starting at verse 35. On the same day when evening had come, he said to them, "Let us cross over to the other side." The same day takes us back to chapter 4, verse 1, where it says, "And again he began to teach by the sea, and a great multitude was gathered to him, so that he got into a boat and sat in it on the sea. And the whole multitude was on the land facing the sea." Now, I don't know how many times Jesus got out of this boat. I don't have any information about that at all. But it's this same setting that occurs here in a different place. So you have this same day where he's speaking in parables from this boat. He's going to have to speak in some more strenuous, let us say, lessons to the disciples because of their fear. So it's calling it the same day, "Let us cross over." This is a frequent word that's used in Luke and Acts to refer to preaching journeys. Let us cross over. And when you see what Jesus did in Mark 5, you'll see that fits here very well with Mark and with Luke and Acts. And also there are fewer people on the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee. It's more spread out. It's more agrarian. And Jesus is exhausted. He's lying in this boat. He's sleeping. And they have to stir him, even in the midst of a storm. He is exhausted from a whole day's work. And a lot of the previous chapter may be reaching partly into chapter 3. Help us to understand why he is so exhausted. Furthermore, it tells us in verse 36, "When they had left the multitude, they took him along in the boat as he was. And other little boats were also with him." They took him along. It was their boat. They're navigating. Jesus wasn't the navigator. He was a carpenter. Now, he knew how to navigate. Of course, he's the creator of all the universe. But he lets them do what they can do. He doesn't do things for us when we can do them for ourselves. And it's their boat. Let them navigate. He's sleepy. And so it says, as he was. He's tired and weary and sleepy, I guess is what that's referring to. Or without going to shore to prepare. He's not saying while he's teaching these people, and he gets through and he says, "Now let me go to the shore and do this or do that, and then we'll come." No, they take him as he is in the boat. He never leaves the boat apparently at that point. And it tells us there were other little boats. We don't know much more about those. If they followed him out to this sea, then they got probably more than they bargained for also. But they came around the boat apparently while Jesus was teaching and were listening to him. So while he's leaving, all these other boats all around him who have been listening, we don't know how far they went, but apparently goes at some degree. But it says they had left the multitude and the other little boats were with him. So it gives the impression they're with him even after he leaves where he was. Well, in verse 37, a great windstorm arose and the waves beat into the boat so that it was already filling. And it's using a present tense there that shows it's just gradually getting more and more water that's staying in this boat instead of going beyond it. It's okay when you have a boat in the water. When you have a water in the boat, you're in trouble. And the more water that gets into the boat, the more trouble you're in. And that's why these disciples start to panic. Matthew's account in Matthew 8:24 says, suddenly a great tempest, whereas Mark used great windstorm, this caused it a great tempest arose. The boat was covered with waves. It's kind of like if you see a lady at her counter with mixer blades going at full force, and you see it's tossing that stuff she's mixing unbelievably. That's more or less what the Sea of Galilee did when it had these great windstorms that came up. The great windstorm that's mentioned here is the word that typically refers to a whirlwind or a hurricane. It means fierce, fierce winds. So we're talking about something that's not a little shower. It's not a slight breeze. This is a situation that would cause even seasoned seamen to be absolutely terrified. Mark tells us the waves were filling the water with the boat. This is an open fishing boat. There was one that was found in 1986, which I find rather fascinating. This is that boat. It was found at the bottom of the Sea of Galilee. It's 2,000 years old at the time of Jesus. It's somewhere between 40 BC and AD 50. It's 27 feet long by 7.5 feet wide. It's made of cedar, pine, jujube, willow, and oak. And it has been preserved all these years under that sea to give us a pretty good indication of what the boat would have looked like that Jesus was in. A representation of this has been made. You can see this in the ESV Study Bible on page 1851. And you'll see here the stern back there. That would have been the area where Jesus was in the prow or the bow of the boat. And the one sail that typically had. And these disciples are in this boat. The 4-foot depth of this wall on these things would be very vulnerable to high waves. And these waves on the Sea of Galilee get far above 4 feet. So it's not surprising that they would be panicking because now the water is getting into the boat. And they know there's one inevitable conclusion to that unless something happens, and that is they go to the bottom of the sea. It had happened many times. It had happened many times on the sea. Now, in Mark 4:38, there's a language of panic. It says, but he was in the stern asleep on a pillow. He's not panicked. He's catching up on his rest. It doesn't matter what the sea's going. Nothing could wake him, apparently. And it says, they awoke him. They have to go get him up. And said to him, teacher, and notice now there'll be three different words that are used by the teachers on this subject. This in Mark 4 call him teacher. Do you not care that we're perishing? If you cared about us, you would have gotten up already and stopped this storm. We're about to go under. Don't you even care? And then you have Luke's account. Luke 8:24. They woke him and called him master, master. Why would they call him master? Well, he's the one who's in control of everything. But it looks as if he's lost control here. If they use the word master as they should have had faith that he's still in control. He hasn't surrendered anything. And then you have Matthew's account in Matthew 8:25. They call him Lord. That's giving him great reverence, as is probable and necessary. And they say, save us. Lord, save us. We perish. The word Lord shows the reverence. The save us is the request. And we perish is the reason why we woke you up and what we want you to do. So this is panic language. Now, why does Matthew say they said one thing, Mark say they said another, and Luke say they said another? Because when you have 12 men in a boat along with the one who's the Son of God, they're going to shout different things. They're going to call him different things. This has the picture of reality written all over it, typical to what we see in emergencies today. Some will shout one thing, some will shout another, but all know the danger they're in. And so they're talking about his perishing. The Lord's peaceful sleep illustrates absolute, perfect trust absolute perfect trust and absence of fear. But to the disciples, it doesn't indicate that. To the disciples, it means he's sleeping on the job. Here's our protector. Here's our Lord. He should be saving us. We're about to die here. The word he is very emphatic. It not only uses the little pronoun for he, but it also lends itself with a little verb that's attached to it, which is one of their ways of saying this emphasizes this word. The disciples are all in a panic, but he, giving great emphasis, very distinct from the terrified crew, is doing something else. He's not panicking in the least. Imagine this scene. This storm comes up and Jesus is wringing his hands. He turns pale and he says, I'm scared to death. What are we going to do? Can we get out of here? Can you guys go back? Can you retrace our journey? Which is the closest shore? Let's get out of here. Can you imagine Jesus panicking? You can't, can you? Because you know how this ends. And you know his character. And you know he's the creator of the heavens and the earth. He's not going to panic. He's in control of all this. There's the point we see here. That if you don't take anything else home, take that home. And we're not even to the applications yet. Okay, furthermore, in Mark's account, their question is, do you not care? That's almost a rebuke, if it's not a rebuke. Lord, do you not care? If I'm lying on a couch somewhere and Janet comes up and shakes me and says, don't you care? The roof's about to cave in. Well, that's a rebuke, and I deserve it. But Jesus doesn't deserve a rebuke here. He's doing nothing wrong. The disciples are under a test, and they're flunking the test. Panic and fear can destroy our faith or it can deploy our faith. We determine what it's going to do. 1 Peter 5, 7, we'll hopefully see this again in a moment. Casting all your care upon him because he cares for you. Cast your care upon him. Don't say that he's neglectful. Now, in verse 39, he arose and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, peace, be still. And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. I tell you, I've said before, if I had the privilege of going back in the Old Testament to see any one miracle, it would be the Red Sea incident when it parted. That would be the miracle I'd want to see. If I could go back to the time of Christ, though I might not be comfortable on this boat if it was sinking, I might be like one of the other disciples shouting louder than they were for all I know. One thing I would love to see is for this tempest, this whirlwind, going on, and Jesus calmly sleeping and then getting up and very calmly saying, peace, be still. And suddenly, it was as though there had never been a storm. I would love to see that, wouldn't you? Now, we see it through their eyes and their words here. It tells us in Luke's account, Luke 8, 24, that he awoke and rebuked the wind, the same as Mark, and the raging waves. Whereas Mark says he said to the sea, Luke says to the raging waves. This is incredible. Not only does the storm stop, not only does the wind quit blowing, but the waves are perfectly still. Now, you know that when there's been a storm, even when the storm leaves, you'll see the waters are still bouncing up and they're still affected by what has happened to them. Here, even the waves are silent and still. It's like a glassy sea, I suppose. And so the billows aren't rolling. He rebuked the storm and it left. You remember in Mark 11, verse 14, there was a time when Jesus came to the fig tree. And it had leaves. If it had leaves, it's advertising there's fruit there. It doesn't put out the leaves till there's fruit. He went up, there's no fruit on it. It was false advertising. And so he said, let no more fruit be grown on you from this day on. The next day they walked by and they saw the trees withered. If it's not going to produce fruit, it's not going to be good for anything. But it says he rebuked that fig tree. Furthermore, in Mark 1:25, there was an occasion when he had an encounter with a demon. Mark 1:25, Jesus rebuked him, saying, be quiet and come out of him. The same word he uses here, rebuked. He rebuked the demon. Whatever he rebukes, it has an effect. And then you see it also in Luke 4, verse 39. Jesus goes where Peter's house apparently is, and his mother-in-law is lying there sick. And Jesus goes up to her, and he He rebukes the fever, and the fever leaves. He could use that word rebuke. He could rebuke something, and it's going to listen to him. He has all authority. Just say the word, one word, and it's gone. To the sea, he said, peace. That means keep silent, make no sound. The second thing he said was, be still. That gives us our word muzzle. Put a muzzle on. Put a muzzle on this thing. You don't make any more noise. Silence. That same word is used in Jonah 1 verse 11 after he was swallowed by the fish. The sea became very, very still. So instantaneously, the wind ceased. There was a great calm. You know, the old saying is, people talk about the weather, but what's the rest of that? Nobody does anything about it, right? Here's somebody who did. Here's somebody who controlled the weather. The one who could create the whole universe can certainly control the weather. And notice also in verse 37, whereas it calls it a great storm, after Jesus gets through with it, now in verse 39, it calls it a great calm. The word great is used two times here. A great storm, verse 37, becomes a great calm, verse 39. In verse 40, but he said to them, why are you so fearful? How is it that you have no faith? In Matthew's account, Matthew 8:26, why are you fearful? Oh, you have little faith. Now, a couple of things about these two passages. He's asking them, why are you so fearful? Wonder what answer they would give him. Could they say, well, we thought we were going to die? And his answer may be, while I'm in the boat? You think you're going to go to the bottom of the sea with me in the boat? Are you so slow in learning about the power I have that you think I'm going to let us all drown? And the second thing, how is it that you have no faith in Mark's account? You have no faith. But in Luke, in Matthew's account, Matthew 8:26, he gives them credit for having little faith. Little faith is about the same thing as no faith, then, isn't it? They're used synonymously here. Little faith doesn't count with the Lord. He wants us to have great faith. Little faith is no faith. So they shouldn't be afraid with Jesus in the boat. He's the matchless teacher, isn't he? But in this passage, he's more often the mighty deliverer. And throughout Mark, he is seen that way. But while we can say they shouldn't have been afraid with him in the boat, can we not also say they shouldn't have been afraid if he had not been in the boat? Because he's still Lord of the universe and still in control, even if he's not with him, isn't he? Isn't that the case? That's what we say, isn't it? If we're doing something, the Lord's not physically present with us, but is he with us in another way? Absolutely. He says that repeatedly. Matthew 18, when we assemble, he's with us. And Matthew 28, I'm sending you to all the world. I'm with you. Lo, I'm with you always. In verse 41, and they feared exceedingly. Now, they've already been afraid. The storm stopped. What do they have to be afraid of? This is my favorite verse in this whole thing. Now, they're really afraid. Why? They feared exceedingly, said to one another, who can this be? That even the wind and the sea obey him. Who has this kind of power? That he can speak a word, three words, peace, be still. And just like that, everything ceases. He's in absolute domination, total control. Imagine it. And now they're really afraid. I suggest to you, you look at the various expressions. Matthew 8:27, the men marveled, saying, what sort of man is this? Let me ask you to pause for a moment. Go back with me to the book of Jonah. The people on the boat with Jonah would have loved it had they been able to see him do what Jesus did here. But Jonah's not the Son of God. Jonah's running from the Lord. He's fleeing to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. And in verse 4, it's the Lord himself who sent out the great wind on the sea. And the mariners were afraid. It's very common to see, even in Scripture, for mariners to get into a situation on the sea. You're going to be afraid at some point. You're going to see storms that you wish didn't occur. And your throat is going to be filled with your heart at that point. We're going to wonder, are we going to make it? But in verse 5, Jonah had gone down into the lowest parts of the ship and lain down and was fast asleep. The captain came and said to him, "What do you mean, sleeper? Arise, call on your God. Perhaps your God will consider us so that we may not perish." They said one to another, "Let's cast lots to see what the cause is." And they saw that it fell on Jonah. So they asked him in verse 8, "What's your occupation? Where'd you come from? What is your country? What people are you?" He said, "I'm a Hebrew and I fear the Lord." That could be questioned, I think, in view of his recent debacle. But he says, "I fear the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land." He made all this that you see. You see? He made it. Oh. So they were exceedingly afraid. It's similar to what we're seeing here in Mark 4. They're already afraid. Now they're exceedingly afraid. And they said, "Why have you done this?" For he had told them he had fled from the Lord. You just don't do that. In verse 11, what should we do to you that the sea may be calm for us? And it was growing more tempestuous. And he said, "Pick me up and throw me into the sea. And the sea will become calm for you. For I know that this great tempest is because of me." They rowed hard. They didn't want to throw him into the sea. That wouldn't work. So they threw him into the sea. And then the result was it ceased from its raging. Verse 15. Then the men feared the Lord exceedingly and offered sacrifice to the Lord and took vows. Don't you know they would have told that in every port where they were for the rest of their life? But here in Jesus' account, you have in Luke, fear plus astonishment. In Mark, they feared with a great fear, quite literally. The drowning danger had passed, but now they're fearing with a great fear because of Jesus. This fear comes after the storm has been calmed. The sight of almighty power has terrified the disciples. And so these disciples were terrified twice, once by the water, but now even more so by the presence of Jesus. In Mark's account, who is this? There are two Jesuses here. There's the fatigue of a sleeping Jesus who can't even be awakened by a mighty storm. And then there is the power of the Jesus who controls the universe. He can speak to the water, the almighty ruler of all nature, as we sing in a song. Now, let's talk about this from three different perspectives. Everybody talks about the weather, but we know how that goes. They don't do anything about it. Jesus, like Jonah, is awakened by a frightened crew. Jonah can pray, but he couldn't stop a storm. In fact, the storm was his fault. But look at Jesus. He makes a point of this in Matthew 12. "The men of Nineveh will rise up in the judgment with this generation and condemn it, because they repented at the preaching of Jonah." Indeed, it's greater than Jonah's here. I think you could start before you get to Nineveh with the people on that boat. They're going to tell you, "This Jonah serves a God who's the greatest. There is no God anywhere like this God." But by the time Jonah gets to Nineveh, they're ready to hear that message that these men have spread from one port to another. Why do the disciples wake Jesus? Do they say, "Jesus, get up and pray for us as Jonah did"? They don't mention anything like that. Or, "Get up and worry with us." You know, the more people who worry, the more things get done, right? Wrong. That's not it. Jesus rebuked the disciples. Now, I find it interesting that to follow Jesus doesn't always guarantee smooth sailing or sunny skies. Think about that. Sometimes a person becomes a Christian and he's opposed by people at work. He may lose his job. That's happened. And he goes home all discouraged. He says, "I did everything right. I became a Christian. I did what I'm supposed to do. It's not supposed to work like this." Oh, how's it supposed to work? Is obeying Jesus an insurance policy that says if I obey him, nothing bad will ever happen to me again? Well, read your New Testament. Could Stephen say, "Well, the Lord let me down, he let me die"? No, what he did was let him go to heaven before he knew he could. What a privilege that is. We have to view it from the Lord's perspective. Can bad things happen to good people? Absolutely, they do all the time. But we have a Lord who can say, "Don't you worry about that. I'm in control. And whether I am in control by saving you out of that or letting you see my power with you through it or taking you to be with me, either way, we win if we're Christians." And that's the lesson the disciples had to learn. How does the Lord's almighty power affect us. What are we doing? Are we going about with fear ruling our life? Does fear crush our faith? What would any of us think if we walked into a kitchen and one of our little children, maybe a 3 or 4 year old, 5 year old, he's sitting there crying. What's wrong? I just got to thinking about how bad the world is, and I'm just afraid you're not going to be able to take care of us. How would you feel? How do we think God feels when we act like these disciples? We're going through difficult times, opposition, hardness, and it's just not an easy life. And we get to worrying and saying, I just don't know if the Lord's going to take care of me. How do you think he feels? What would he tell us? He called these disciples, you have little faith, or you have no faith. What would he say about us? I hope we would have enough faith to realize no matter what happens to us, it's going to be all right if we're with him. Isn't it natural to be afraid in a storm at sea? Well, I think there are things that make our heart beat faster. If we're riding in a car and somebody is talking to me instead of watching what he's doing, he's over in the left lane and a semi is about to hit his head on, I suspect my heart rate would go up, wouldn't yours? I suspect I'd rather be somewhere else, wouldn't you? He's not saying we have to be dunces that don't even know what's about to happen, but what he does say is, if the worst happens, we're ready if we're Christians. That's what he says. That's what he's telling these disciples, basically. You know, in Acts chapter 12, you have Herod who slays James, but he cannot get a hold of Peter. An angel rescues Peter. Why was this? Why didn't he rescue both of them? I don't know the answer to that, do you? I just know that James, in one way, was the favored of the two. Because why is he following Christ anyway? To go and be with God. Where is he? He went to be with God. Where's Peter? He's still here among other people. James is the one who is exalted and blessed. Peter's the one who still has quite a bit of work to do. It depends on how you look at it. The eye of faith sees things that Jonah's and the disciples weren't seeing. Now they do see. And Peter, again, is living by 1 Peter 5, verse 7, after Jesus finally drilled it into them long enough in the earthly ministry. Consider this parallel. In Acts 5:41, look at the attitude of the disciples when they're facing the Sanhedrin with the power to kill them. Their attitude is this: so they departed from the presence of the council, rejoicing that they were counted worthy to suffer shame for his name. What's their attitude? It's an honor to suffer for him. Now look at verse 42. Look at their actions. Daily in the temple, they cowered down and were afraid like bunny rabbits with a pack of hounds coming after them. Is that what it said? No. Daily in the temple, in every house, they did not cease teaching and preaching Jesus the Christ. What did the Sanhedrin tell them? Don't you preach in this name. What are they doing? They're saying, we take our orders from the one who can still the sea and calm the winds. Can you do that? Until you can, we're going to listen to him. That's their effect of all these miracles he worked and these lessons he taught them. In Romans 10:17, faith comes by hearing and hearing by the word of God. Think about this with these disciples. Faith comes by hearing the word of God. What did he say to the disciples? He said, let us cross over on the other side. What did he not say? Let us cross over to halfway on the Sea of Galilee and let a storm come up and ship us down to Davy Jones' locker. Is that what he said? No. His words were, let us go across to the other side of the sea. If they had listened to his words, and his words can never be broken, they could have been asleep like he was. Nothing's going to happen to harm them with him making that statement. Listen to the word of the Lord. That's what we must do. Listen to the word of the Lord. In Acts 27, to take it one step further, Saul of Tarsus, Paul the Apostle, is on a ship. Now, these are not the shipwrecks mentioned in 2 Corinthians 11, where he said, I spent a night and a day in the deep. This is after. And yet, he didn't calm the storm for Paul. I was a night and a day in the deep. On this occasion, it rages for 2 weeks at least. 2 weeks. Imagine in a storm for 2 weeks. And yet Paul is the only sane one, along with Aristarchus and Luke, on that boat. Even the sailors are panicking. These are perfectly calm. Paul has learned the lesson, though he wasn't on that boat with the previous disciples. The Lord can save us from trouble or in trouble. Here's what Paul says about it. 2 Corinthians 4:1, who comforts us in all our tribulation, that we may be able to comfort those who are in any trouble with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God. God can save us from death or in death. And you see that in James and Peter. Now, the second thing I want us to see here is everybody knows that trouble comes to those who deserve it. Notice a little question mark there. There's a sort of a tongue-in-cheek here. What are we talking about here? Trouble comes to those who deserve it. Well, let's think about this trip the disciples made with Jesus. Whose idea was it? Well, it was Jesus' idea. Jesus called for this voyage. How much blame do the disciples have for saying, let's get on the sea and have a pleasure ride? Nothing. They had nothing to do with where they go. That was Jesus who made this plan. I wouldn't doubt that Jesus made this plan knowing that this storm would come up to teach them this lesson. I'm not going to say one way or another because I wasn't there and I don't know and I haven't talked to him about it. But I do know this. The disciples were not doing wrong. The storm was not their fault. And yet, storms, hard times, don't always imply disobedience on our part. You can go through terribly hard times. And we've just seen that with the apostles. We've seen the persecution that Saul of Tarsus, Paul, went through. So, no waters, as we sing in a song, no waters can swallow the ship where lies the master of ocean and earth and skies. Think about that. That was written based on Matthew 8, Luke 8, and Mark 4. And also, when the disciples were with Jesus, they were in the safest place on earth. No matter what's going on around us, if we're with Christ, he says, Matthew 18, Matthew 28, he's with us. If we're with Christ, we need not fear. The faithful child of God can hope in life or in death. Whether it's sickness, slaughter, starvation, it doesn't matter. Romans 8 comes into play here, but we won't take the time to go into that right now because of this third point. Everybody knows that Jesus was just a man. Notice the question mark. There's no question about it. We know he wasn't just a man. He was a man, but he wasn't just a man. The disciples see his humanity very plainly. What's he doing? Well, he's tired and he's sleepy. That's the function of a tired human being. We get tired, we get sleepy. So did Jesus. He's a man. But the disciples also see his deity. You see, he's not just a one-natured being. He is a two-natured being. He's human and he's divine. He's man and he's God. So that the almighty power over nature was his to control. He wasn't just a man, and he wasn't just a man through whom God worked miracles. He was a man with his own inherent power that he channeled and used according to the Father's will during this period of his humiliation. Now, why would they come to Jesus, a carpenter? These are the sailors on the ship. Why would they come to a carpenter? They wanted to bail water. Jonah, a man, was saved by a miracle. Jesus saved others by a miracle. There's quite a difference in a mere man, Jonah, and the true God-man, Jesus. And then what mere man could do what Jesus did? If Jesus is just a man, let's get out on the Sea of Galilee and let one of these storms come up, and they come up frequently. Let's see what he can do with it. Let's see if he can say, peace be still, and stop it. And if they can do that, then I'll say, yes, Jesus is just a man. Well, that's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. But nobody wants to take that challenge because this is dangerous water. More about that in a moment. Now, I would suggest to you that in Genesis 1, 1 through 3, when the Lord said, let there be light and there was light, let there be, he created the heavens and the earth, let there be, let there be, let there be. That's power. I mean, that is awesome power. But if you'll notice in John 1, we get a peek into what's going on behind the scenes here. Because it tells us in verse 1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. This Word, whoever he is, and he's identified in verse 14 as Christ, this Word is not only with God, with the Father, but he is himself God, that is deity. Now, verse 2, he was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him. Go back to Genesis 1. Let there be light. Let there be. Let there be. Let there be. Who's doing it? Jesus is. All things were made through him. And without him, nothing was made that was made. Is John just a kook? He didn't know Jesus? Oh, he was one of the few men in the world who did know Jesus. What skeptic can duplicate what Jesus did? If he's just a man, let him duplicate. If Jesus is God, how could the Jews kill him, somebody says. Listen very carefully. Anyone can still a storm. No. But anyone who can still a storm cannot be killed by wicked men unless he allows it. And Jesus, the Son of God, allowed it. That was the Father's plan. He lived that he might die, and he died that we might live. And it worked out perfectly in the Father's plan and in his power. This highlights the love of the Messiah. So enough of the talk of the world that says he was just a man. There's just too much evidence to the contrary to hold that position. He conquered death with resurrection. Now, fear and faith are contrary as the disciples face a storm. They're looking at the storm. They're seeing the water come into the boat. It's starting to fill up. Faith and fear don't mix at that point. You need faith and not fear. They're contrary to the one to the other. The fear will take away your faith. Let's look at it from a different angle. When you're looking at Jesus and his power, faith and fear are consistent. We have both faith and fear in him. The right kind of fear, our reverential awe for him, while our faith continues to grow and to appreciate who he is. Some fear is good. Philippians 2:12, therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, with a wholesome dread of doing anything that would displease him. He is the God of the universe. Hebrews 12:28, therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom which cannot be shaken, let us have grace, by which we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear. You know, humans think they're so smart. I say they, I'm one of them too. Mark 4 puts us in our place. It puts us in our place. Some disciples were expert sailors and had seen many storms, and they turned to a carpenter, but much more than a carpenter. Someone they knew could help them. I was on the Sea of Galilee many years ago now. The tour guide took us out to about the middle of it, and he stopped the boat. And he told us about a former group that he had let out. And he said the way it happened was, he said there was storm brewing this day. It wasn't a good day to be on the Sea of Galilee. You can tell the cold air is coming down those rivulets, and it's starting to get a little choppy. And they said, we haven't come all this way not to see the Sea of Galilee. We're going to go out on it. So he finally relented and took them out. They were there just a few minutes when the storm came. He couldn't get them to shore fast enough. They were scared out of their wits. There was no Jesus in that boat to stop this storm. And while they did get to see it, they saw far more than they wanted. Several years ago, there was a man by the name of W.M. Christie who spent many years in Galilee. He made this comment. A company of visitors stood on shore at Tiberias, noting the glassy surface of the water and the smallness of the lake. They expressed doubts as to the possibility of such storms as described in the Gospels. Almost immediately, the wind sprang up. In 20 minutes, the sea was white with foam-crested waves. Great billows broke over the towers at the corners of the city walls. The visitors were compelled to shelter from the blinding spray, though now 200 yards from the lakeside. It gets your attention. Remember, the disciples were scared because of the storm, but they were terrified in the presence of this one who could stop that storm. Let us have that same kind of respect and awe for our Lord. Thank you for listening. If anyone needs to obey the gospel, you know of a better time than now. Come to him. The one who saves has the power to save us eternally. If you need to repent and be baptized to be forgiven or to turn back to him, we invite you to come as we stand and sing.